Hi, this is Steven, the host, talking to you from the future, a year after this episode has first been released. We've noticed that our talk with Timothy Parikh seems to be of continued interest to many international listeners in particular. If you are one of these international listeners, let it be said that our talk with Timothy starts at 9 minutes and 55 seconds. That is 9 minutes and 55 seconds. So now you can go ahead and skip all that pesky German. Und für all die anderen geht's jetzt los. 1972, vor mittlerweile mehr als 50 Jahren, veröffentlichten Donella Meadows und ihre Kollegen das Buch »Die Grenzen des Wachstums«. In dem unerwarteten Bestseller stellen die Systemforscher die Ergebnisse ihrer Studie über die Entwicklung verschiedener menschenverursachter Wachstumsprozesse vor. Wie wird sowas zu einem Bestseller? Ganz einfach. Der Grund für den Erfolg waren die erschreckenden Ergebnisse. Denn die Forscher kamen zu der Feststellung, dass das exponentielle Wachstum der Weltbevölkerung, der Umweltverschmutzung, der Nahrungsmittelproduktion und des Rohstoffabbaus in den kommenden 100 Jahren absolute Limits erreichen würden. Diese Wachstumslimits beruhen zum einen auf der Endlichkeit der Ressourcen, aber auch zum anderen auf sogenannten Systemgrenzen der Ökosphäre. Die Forscher stellten auch fest, dass das Wirtschaftswachstum, dem all die zuvor genannten Wachstumsprozesse zugrunde liegen, an den Anstieg der Umweltschäden gekoppelt ist. Mit anderen Worten, wächst unsere Wirtschaft um 2%, so steigen auch die Emissionen gemittelt im gleichen exponentiellen Maße. Die finale Feststellung der Studie besagte dann, dass es im Falle der Überschreitung dieser Systemgrenzen langfristig nicht nur zum Ende des Wachstums, sondern gar zu einem Zusammenbruch des ökologischen und des wirtschaftlichen Systems kommen würde. Als das Buch erschien, 1972, waren nur wenige der ökologischen Grenzwerte bereits überschritten. Doch schon bei Veröffentlichung der Zweitausgabe im Jahr 2004 mussten die Autoren feststellen, dass viele Systemgrenzen in den Zwischenjahren überschritten wurden. Nun, im Jahr 2022, ist eindeutig klargestellt, dass mehrere Grenzen weit überschritten sind. Doch ein Ende des Wachstums ist natürlich bei weitem nicht in Sicht. Und deswegen wollen wir uns heute eine der wirklichen Grundfragen der nachhaltigen Entwicklung stellen. Können wir das Wirtschaftswachstum von den Umweltschäden und dem Ressourcenverbrauch abkoppeln? Können wir in der Zukunft auf ein grünes Wachstum setzen? Oder müssen wir zum Erhalt des stabilen Ökosystems in eine Postwachstumsökonomie übergehen? Später in dieser Folge spreche ich mit dem französischen Politökonomen Timothy Parikh über genau diese Fragen, wie man Wirtschaftswachstum und Nachhaltigkeit zusammenbringen kann oder ob man das überhaupt kann und welche alternativen Wirtschaftsmodelle es geben könnte. Aber erstmal müssen wir dem Titel des Podcasts gerecht werden, ein paar Grundlagen schaffen und die Zusammenhänge zwischen Wirtschaftswachstum und Umweltschäden genau betrachten. Beginnen müssen wir hierfür mit einer kleinen Exkursion in die Nachhaltigkeitstheorie. Das klingt doch sehr spannend. Da gibt es so ein Konzept, das nennt sich die planetaren Grenzen. Diese planetaren Grenzen stellen die ökologischen Grenzen unserer Erde dar. Bei der Überschreitung dieser Grenzen verliert unser Ökosystem an Stabilität und nimmt damit quasi die Lebensgrundlage der Menschheit. Dabei gibt es 9 von diesen ökologischen Belastungsgrenzen. Einige von ihnen mögen den meisten sehr bekannt sein. Da wären zum Beispiel die Konzentration von CFC und anderen Stoffen, die der Ozonschicht schaden. Weitere bekannte Grenzen wären wohl der Süßwasserverbrauch, das Artensterben, die Luftverschmutzung, die Abholzung und natürlich die Freisetzung von Treibhausgasen. Weniger bekannt, aber nicht weniger wichtig sind die Ozeanversauerung, die Grenzen um den Phosphor- und Stickstoffkreislauf, die auch mit der Fruchtbarkeit unserer Böden zusammenhängen, und die Einführung neuartiger, oft chemischer Substanzen in die Ökosphäre. Für jede dieser 9 Kategorien gibt es einen sicheren Belastungsraum. Bleibt die Konzentration der Stoffe oder die Intensität der Prozesse in dem sicheren Belastungsraum, dann leben wir nachhaltig. Ist die Obergrenze des Belastungsraums überschritten, betreten wir den unsicheren Belastungsraum, in dem das System an Stabilität und Resilienz verliert. Die oberste Grenze ist der sogenannte Kipppunkt. Ist der Kipppunkt überschritten, wird das Ökosystem auf kurz oder lang kollabieren. Die Überschreitung eines solchen Kipppunkts wird in Meadows Grenzen des Wachstums als Overshooting beschrieben und kann nach einer zeitlichen Verzögerung abrupte und unumkehrbare Veränderungen verursachen. Und wie sieht's aus? Wo stehen wir? Nun, gute Nachricht zuerst, in wohl 4 der 9 Kategorien befinden wir uns global noch unter dem sicheren Belastungslimit. Bei der Abholzung und der Klimakrise sind wir zwar im Unsicherheitsbereich, jedoch noch nicht über dem Kipppunkt. Aber beim Artensterben, Beim Stickstoff und Phosphor und bei der Einbringung chemischer Substanzen sind die Kipppunkte bereits überschritten. Zudem rücken wir bei der Klimakrise und auch bei der Abholzung immer näher an diese jeweiligen Kipppunkte. Die treibenden Kräfte hinter dieser Eskalation sind, wie von Meadows beschrieben, das Bevölkerungs- und Wirtschaftswachstum. So ist zum Beispiel ein Anstieg des Bruttoinlandsproduktes direkt mit einem Anstieg der Treibhausgasemissionen verknüpft. Seit der industriellen Revolution sei zu beobachten, dass bei wachsender Wirtschaft und wachsendem Wohlstand die ökologische Integrität sinkt. Daher galt auch bislang, wer Emissionen wirklich sinken möchte, müsste eigentlich ein negatives Wirtschaftswachstum in Kauf nehmen. Macht natürlich keiner. Aber wir leben ja mittlerweile im 21. Jahrhundert. Müsste es nicht eine Lösung zu diesem Problem geben? Es hoffen zumindest viele, dass mit dem technologischen Fortschritt diese Kopplung von Umweltbelastung und Wirtschaftswachstum umgangen werden kann. Durch erneuerbare Energien soll der Energieverbrauch klimaneutral werden. Durch Recycling soll der Rohstoffverbrauch gesenkt werden und durch Carbon Capture und Storage Technologien sollen bereits entstandene Emissionen wieder aus der Atmosphäre entfernt werden. Mit der Hilfe dieser und weiterer Technologien kann die Umweltbelastung relativ zur Wirtschaftskraft gesenkt werden. Falls eine solche Abkopplung auf dem globalen Level und nicht nur in den bereits wohlhabenden Ländern erreicht werden könnte, würde zukünftig Wirtschaftswachstum auch ohne steigende Emissionen möglich sein. Dieses Abkopplungskonzept, auch Decoupling genannt, ist die Grundlage der deutschen und europäischen Klimastrategien. Von den Grünen über die FDP bis hin zur CDU ist das die Grundlage der Pläne. Und auch der europäische Green Deal setzt im großen Maße auf ein erfolgreiches Decoupling, wie Ursula von der Leyen erklärt.
Therefore, the European Green Deal is on one hand about cutting emissions, but on the other hand about creating jobs and boosting innovation. I'm convinced that the old growth model that is based on fossil fuels and pollution is out of date and it is out of touch with our planet. The European Green Deal is our new growth strategy. It's a strategy for growth that gives more back than it takes away.
Technologischer Fortschritt, der zu umweltfreundlicheren Industrien führt, das ist demnach der Lösungsansatz. Und man muss anerkennen, in Ländern wie Dänemark und Schweden sind Anzeichen für den Erfolg der Entkopplung bereits seit dem Jahr 2000 zu erkennen. In beiden Fällen stieg das Bruttoinlandsprodukt langsam aber stetig, während zumindest die Treibhausgasemissionen gesenkt werden konnten. Das mag vor allem an der Entwicklung hin zu einer Dienstleistungs- und Finanzwirtschaft und weg von den produzierenden Gewerben liegen, doch die positive Entwicklung ist nicht von der Hand zu weisen. Der Green Deal setzt darauf, diesen Trend auf die gesamteuropäische Wirtschaft zu übertragen. Wohlgemerkt, sowohl Schweden als auch Dänemark sind noch weit von einer nachhaltigen oder gar klimaneutralen Wirtschaft entfernt. Und dennoch, das Vertrauen in die Innovationskraft des Marktes mit Hilfe durch Anreize und Investitionen aus der Politik ist enorm. Gelinge es wirklich, den Green Deal weltweit erfolgreich umzusetzen, nicht nur in der EU, wäre zumindest der Kipppunkt der Klimakrise umgangen. Doch aus der Wissenschaft kommt teils immense Kritik. Decoupling kann laut den Kritikern nicht ausreichend dafür sorgen, unsere Emissionen zu senken. Zumindest nicht dann, wenn die Wirtschaft weiter wächst und der Konsum weiter ansteigt. So meinte Harald Welzer im Interview mit Monitor.
Selbst wenn wir zu Emissionsreduktionen kommen würden, sprechen wir von Emissionsreduktionen. Wir sprechen nicht davon, dass die Emissionen aufhören oder auf Null gehen. Nur das, was das Klima schädigt, was die Temperatursteigerung antreibt, wird ein wenig reduziert. Aber der Prozess als solcher geht weiter.
Was Harald Welzer hier ausdrücken möchte, ist, glaube ich, keine Kritik an dem Konzept der Entkopplung selbst. Dass Entkopplungsprozesse in bestimmtem Maße funktionieren, ist kaum umstritten. Die Kritik richtet sich stattdessen an diejenigen, die die Wirkungskraft solcher Entkopplungsmechanismen überschätzen. Über diese Problematik und über alternative Modelle zum grünen Wachstum habe ich mit dem französischen Politökonomen Timothée Parrick gesprochen. Timothée hat einen Doktorabschluss in Postwachstumstheorie von der Universität Clermont-Auvergne und vom Stockholm Resilience Center. Sein 2019 veröffentlichter Bericht Decoupling Debunked, den er im Auftrag des Europäischen Umweltbüros schrieb, wird unter anderem im neuesten IPCC-Bericht zitiert. Das Interview mit Timothée fand auf Englisch statt. Hi, Timothy. Thank you for taking the time to speak to us today.
Yeah, happy to be here.
And we're happy to have you. Let us start by talking about the term decoupling. In your own words, what are the central claims of that concept? And where do you see the problems with how it is popularly presented?
There are two concepts we need to understand here. It's decoupling and green growth. So decoupling is an hypothesis that exists since the 1990s that says that at some point an economy can dissociate the growth of its GDP, so its level of production and consumption, with the impact it has on nature. That's why decoupling, because imagine those two curves, GDP going up and different measures of environmental pressures also going up. They're coupled. You want to decouple them so you can keep producing and consuming more. GDP keeps going up, but the measurement of your environmental pressures goes down. For example, greenhouse gas emissions. And that decoupling would lead to green growth. Why would that growth be green? Because it will be extra points of GDP that do not bring extra point of environmental pressures.
Yeah, thank you for that explanation. Now, as I'm aware, it gets a little bit more complicated than that, doesn't it? So let us talk about relative and absolute decoupling as well. Mm-hmm. So for example, let's imagine that both the GDP and the emissions of Germany grew by 2% in 2015. And if then in 2021, the GDP of Germany would still grow at 2%, but the total emissions would only increase by 1%. They still grow, but only by 1%. This would already be successful relative decoupling, wouldn't it? Even though, I mean, our total emissions would still be increasing. This would, however, not be considered absolute decoupling. Have I gotten this right?
Exactly. So if you have a 2% rise in GDP and a 1% rise in emissions, your emissions are still rising. So let's say you're more efficient than you were before. An economist would say that the carbon intensity of your GDP has decreased because before it was, you know, 2% and now it's 1%. So you actually just, you know, you're just cutting your emissions faster. But the total tons of CO2 that your economy is emitting is still rising. To get absolute decoupling, you would need to get, for example, plus 2% GDP in 1 year and minus 1% of emission. So it means, you know, from last year to this year, you need to have a lower absolute number of tons rejected into the atmosphere. So here we get the first difference of course, as the climate scientists tell us, we need to reduce emissions. So relative decoupling is not a mitigation strategy. But let's be careful about something. If your GDP rise by 2% and your emissions stay stable, they don't decrease, but they don't increase, this would be considered as absolute decoupling. And we need to be careful about this, especially in the latest IPCC report, the mitigation report, because some studies being quoted in the IPCC report as proof of absolute decoupling, then you look into them, but it's actually this kind of GDP-led absolute decoupling where GDP increase, and your emission just stabilizes. If you are in a strategy of carbon mitigation, stabilizing emissions in a country like Germany, France, or any countries that has actually overshoot its carbon budget, well, this is not a mitigation strategy. So this is not green growth. What you want, and here I'm going into the realm of science fiction because we've never seen this in the history of mankind. And theoretically, I don't think we will ever see this in the future history of mankind. We would need a situation where you have, for example, plus 2% of GDP per year and minus 15% emissions.
Yeah.
If you have this every year from now to 2030, to the point where you're actually carbon neutral, then you can call this, you know, an effective mitigation strategy, because your emissions every year are actually being reduced fast enough to reach, you know, the safe threshold of limiting climate change to 1.5 degrees, for example. And this is what I find quite misleading about the way we talk about decoupling in the IPCC report and in general. People, as soon as they see some kind of decoupling, let it be relative decoupling most of the time, or these absolute decoupling where emissions are just stabilizing, or in a handful of cases in the world, less than 20 countries, absolute decoupling where emissions actually decrease just a tiny bit, maybe 1%, maybe 2%, maybe at some point during a year because there's a recession of some kind, then you have a 3 or 4%, but that's always temporary. And we call these forms of decoupling kind of mitigation victories, whereas from a pure, you know, climate science perspective, they're just nowhere near what we would need to actually make that growth green. This is I'm usually bringing the argument towards some form of degrowth. Of if the goal is to reduce emissions, that's going to be more difficult to do it in an economy that is constantly increasing the amount of stuff it produces.
We're getting to that point of degrowth in a second. I want to stay on the decoupling for a second and complicate it a bit further. The report... The report you were talking about just now, the latest IPCC report, it has a quote of a paper from Klaus Hubach in it, which says that during the period from 2015 to 2018, 23 countries have achieved absolute decoupling of consumption-based emissions and GDP, while 32 countries achieved absolute decoupling of production-based emissions and GDP. Now, we've already heard the problems with this absolute GDP in general, but... As a final complication of it, can you explain what the difference with a consumption-based emission is and a production-based emission?
Okay, so you have two ways to measure emissions. Production-based indicators, also called domestic indicators, will estimate the emission of an economy based on what it produces in its territory. So let's take France. The production-based emissions of France includes everything that is produced in France, okay? But we realized over the years that because countries like France have been deindustrializing, meaning that instead of producing cars and stuff like this, they just started to import cars and stuff like this from other countries. Well, these production-based indicators were not really a true reflection of the carbon footprint of the French economy. So people developed in the 2010s what they called consumption-based indicators. So a consumption-based indicator, also called a footprint, you start from what is being consumed, regardless of where it's produced. So all the cars consumed used in France, whether they're produced in France or in Germany or in China, are included in the carbon footprint of France. When you do this, of course, you realize, and for the case of France, if you only look at domestic emissions, you get the impression that it's been greening its growth because domestic emissions have been reducing quite significantly from the 1990s. But if you compare this with the French carbon footprint, so included so-called imported emissions, you realize that actually it has increased. So that's quite important when we do these decoupling studies now, because all these economies are all entangled in a global supply chain, that we take into account consumption-based indicators.
So consumption-based emissions is what we would want to look at. Now, when people advocate for green growth, do they at least generally use this consumption-based metric? Or do they talk about the production-based metric, which is less telling, as you say?
I think the people that are trying to show that green growth is happening are systematically using production-based indicators, because for countries that import a lot of product, that make it look like they're make them look greener than they actually are. So, of course, if you're a politician trying to show that somehow, you know, you're just managing to green your economy, it's probably better to use production-based indicators. But now, if you look at the literature, so decoupling studies, you have around almost 900 empirical studies since the 1990s. 92% of them are using production-based indicators. So now we realize that we basically have to redo a lot of studies that we did before to just test whether we were right or wrong. I'll give you an example. A quite a famous study was published by Jan Rockström and Per Stones in 2018, showing that Denmark, Finland, Norway, and Sweden, you know, had managed what they called genuine green growth, you know, so green growth at a rate of emission cuts faster than 5% per year. Problem, they use production-based emission. So last year, someone else redid the calculus using consumption-based emissions and found out that actually this country is now very far from the so-called genuine green growth. So that's why the difference really matters. But let me go back to...
Timothy, let me say you're phenomenal because my next question would have been about that specific paper, but thank you for answering it already. Sorry.
I can read the future.
Should we move on to the to degrowth then? Because I guess your argument would be. Oh, did you have anything else to say?
Yeah, I wanted to say something because you mentioned Klaus Ubasek, right? One of the lead author of Chapter 2 and the section of decoupling in the IPCC report, and you mentioned his study where he's showing that 23 countries have achieved absolute decoupling, and it's quite important to understand. Remember at the beginning, I was explaining the difference between absolute decoupling, where you're just stabilizing emissions, and absolute decoupling, or just decreasing emissions a tiny, tiny bit. And that genuine absolute decoupling, when you're actually cutting massively, when I say massively, I mean yearly double-digit decrease in carbon emissions. And when you look at the actual study from 2021 that is being used in the IPCC report, I mean, you can read that, you know, in developed countries, and here I'm quoting, in developed countries, consumption-based emissions peaked at 15 gigaton of CO2 in 2007, with a subsequent 16% decline until 2016 and a slight rebound of 1.6% until 2018. Mm-hmm. So here you have the perfect case of absolute decoupling with quasi like very just stabilization or just very slight decrease, which bring the author, lead author Klaus Ubasek, to just conclude the paper writing that these countries, quote, cannot serve as a role models for the rest of the world, given that their decoupling was only achieved at very high levels of per capita emissions. Now, I'm continuing a bit with this paper because it's very important. Listen to what the author concludes. He says that, quote, absolute decoupling is insufficient to avoid consuming the remaining CO2 emission budget under the global warming limit of 1.5 degrees or even 2 degrees and avoid potential climate breakdown. In the last paragraph of the conclusion, at the end of the article being used in the IPCC report, we're not talking about some blog post. They write, even though some countries have achieved absolute decoupling, they are still adding emissions to the atmosphere, thus showing the limits of green growth and the growth paradigm. Even if all countries decouple in absolute terms, this might still not be sufficient to avert dangerous climate change. Therefore, decoupling can only serve as one of the indicators and steps toward fully decarbonizing the economy and society. End of quote by, I recall, the lead author of Chapter 2 of the latest IPCC mitigation report, summarizing his own article, The State of the Science on Decoupling. So here this is...
The language has changed a bit from the paper to the IPCC report.
I mean, if you read the full report, the 2,913 pages report, and you go into the section on decoupling, you'll see that actually it is quite a cautious. But that when that full report gets into the technical summary, all of a sudden, then it's become suddenly very optimist. And when you get to the summary for policymaker, magic, then decoupling is a given. It happens. It's fantastic. We just need to continue. So there's a huge divergence between what the science is saying and how that science is being, I would say, diluted, but let's say interpreted politically by the way the summary for policymakers was written.
Then let us talk about other solutions to the dilemma. let us go ahead and talk about alternative models for green growth. I'm thinking here of post-growth, of A-growth, D-growth, which I think in German we call Postwachstumstheorie, so that would retranslate and change into post-growth again. Not sure where there's the difference. Anyways, what are these terms? How are they different? Or are they actually all the same? Can you give us an explanation, an introduction to this?
Okay. So imagine it like this. There are three main terms, and they all are in the same concept, but it's a concept that has been developing, an idea that has been developing since the 1970s. So let's come back to the 1970s. You remember limits to growth, the Meadows report in 1972, and many others, ecologists who just start to develop what we would call today an objection to growth. That's the, you know, criticism of infinite growth is not possible on a finite planet. This is, let's say, the breeding ground for what we would later call degrowth. But back then, it's only called objection to growth. That's the first concept to understand. Then in 2002 in France, the concept of décroissance is born. So that's the degrowth. This one builds, of course, on the 1970 criticism of economic growth and capitalism and productivism and many other things, but it just adds other things. The main difference, as you can imagine, in the 1970s, we were still worrying about if we continue to produce more, we'll hit some ecological walls. In 2002, we have hit them. We have trespassed planetary boundaries. So it's not just a matter of worrying anymore. It's actually a matter of reducing the size of your economy, of producing and consuming less. So that's why it's just not only an objection to growth, even though it is still an objection to further growth, it is an actual call for degrowing. So that's the evolution number two, a bit like a Pokemon, you know, level one was objection to growth. Pokemon level two is degrowth. And then we get to Pokemon level three in around 2010s post-growth. So the way I like to make the difference between this is imagine if now we admit that somehow we won't be able to green growth. And so we also acknowledge the fact that high-income countries have unsustainable living standards. And so therefore, we need to shrink the size of their economy. So we need to degrow them, but we will not degrow them forever. We'll just, you know, shrink them back to a level that can be sustainable. So that phase could be called degrowth. But then once that phase is over, you enter the realm of post-growth. And here I like the concept of Tim Jackson, you know, from his 2009 book, Prosperity Without Growth. So this is the thing. Once you've done your diet, then you need to organize your economy so it can prosper without growing, without especially the need to grow, to finance public services, to create jobs, to do whatever you want your economy to do. So that's level three of the Pokemon evolution of the concept of degrowth. So now you mentioned A-growth. A-growth is not really a concept. It's very small compared to these two. It was just back at the beginning of the 2000s, the French economist Serge Latouche, one of the first to really theorize degrowth as an idea, was always repeating this a little quip in his writing. It was saying, actually, we should not be calling it degrowth. We should be calling it A-growth in the sense of atheism, because we should stop. We should start to unbelieve in the religion of growth. So for Serge Latouche, and this is an idea that has remained within the degrowth literature, economic growth is not only a phenomenon, it's also an ideology. It's a system. And so to be able to shrink the size of your economy, you need to unbelieve in the ideology of growth and dismantle the many institutions that actually create this imperative for an economy to grow. So it started with this reflection from Serge Latouche. So here, A-growth and D-growth, same thing. But a bit later, it was retaken in a paper by Jérôme van der Berg, a scholar at the Autonomous University of Barcelona, who took a bit of a middle position, not as radical as D-growth thing, actually, I'm not for growth, I'm not for degrowth, I'm for A growth, meaning I don't care about GDP, I just want sustainability and well-being, and then the GDP, I don't care. This is a position that has also been famously defended by Kate Raworth in our fantastic Donut Economics book, where she's saying, well, GDP is an absolute indicator, so who cares? Actually, let's do what we have to do for the planet. Let's do what we have to do for the people. And then, you know, whether it increased GDP, whether it decreased GDP, I don't quite care.
Yeah.
If you ask me personally, I don't think the A growth concept is quite useful, especially because when you look at, you know, what the an IPCC curve, and, you know, ask a 12-year-old to describe where the curve is going, you know, the curve is just, that's where we're going, straight up. That's where we need to go. Massive decrease. If GDP is coupled with environmental pressures, this means a shrinking of the size of the monetary economy in high-income countries. There is just no way around it. So calling it A growth, or calling it a well-being economy or an economy for the common good, it's a bit like too fast. Like that's, or calling it even post-growth is a bit too fast. No, right now the challenge is one of downscaling, is one of degrowth. And, you know, then in the future, we can change the term. And of course, then after that degrowth transition, it will make more sense to talk of a post-growth, an economy that can prosper without growth, where we can have an A-growth governance of the economy that focuses on social health and ecological resilience. But right now, we're just at the beginning of this kind of alcoholic anonymous phase where, you know, we're not calling ourselves the sobriety club yet. We're just focusing on the problem. And the problem right now is the worship of economic growth in these rich nations.
You were mentioning in your explanation that in our developed high-income European countries, we have this immediate need to shrink the economy, to shrink the economic output and its detrimental effects on the environment. Now, I imagine that this approach, this degrowth approach, should be somewhat different for developing countries in the global south, for example. So how would the degrowth approach differ between privileged Western nations like Germany and lower income countries?
Yeah, I mean, say it like this. How would the approach differ in terms of, you know, nourishment and diet from someone that is suffering from obesity to someone that is suffering from malnourishment? So someone suffering from obesity, you would need to just, you know, eat less and change the quality of what you eat. And someone in malnourishment, you need to eat more. This is perfectly the situation we have now, except it's more complex because we have a finite quantity of resources, especially starting with climate space. Right now, the IPCC is telling us, well, here is the safe number of tons of CO2 you can emit to limit global warming to a certain degree. So now we have, if these tons, we emit them in the north by producing more, that's one climate space that's not going to be available in the global south. So I see degrowth as a strategy for global justice. Shrink environmental pressures as fast as possible in these countries that have already produced enough to satisfy the needs of their population, and where poverty and inequality is a problem of distribution, not of absolute volume of production. And do this in order to safeguard a part of these resources for regions, countries, and households, some of them living in rich countries, where net needs remain unmet. So you see, like, if we want to simplify, we could say that degrowth in the global north is necessary to have green growth, or let's say a rather sustainable development in the global south.
On a logical, scientific level, that makes a lot of sense to me. But I also think that to a lot of people hearing of the concept of degrowth for the first time, this whole idea sounds quite scary. I mean, if you're living in a country like Germany, in a country like France, you might be very privileged on a global level, but you probably also won't feel how comparatively privileged your life actually is. And now degrowth sounds like the very end of the basis of our economic system. And to some, it may sound like a degradation of that system, like losing the comforts of modern life. I think this is a very common criticism that you've heard many times. Some kind of sorry to bring it up, but to soothe those minds, what would life in a degrowth economy look like? How drastically would we have to change our habits?
There is this saturation hypothesis that we observe in high-income countries where GDP per capita stops to correlate with well-being. And so if the saturation hypothesis is true, then reducing GDP in these countries must not necessarily lead to a decrease in quality of life if, and that's an important if, you manage to reorganize your economy based on the satisfaction of needs. And so when I think about how this would look like concretely, I mean, imagine now all studies from all over the social science that study the main determinants of well-being tell us that the stuff we take most pleasure in doing are, you know, time-intensive quality activity, like taking a stroll in nature, spending time with our loved ones, reading a book, going to the museum, all that stuff. And so in an economy that we produce and consume less, it's an economy that will have more free time. So imagine what you could do if perhaps you have less income, perhaps you won't be able to purchase many things that you're purchasing before, but this you would trade against available time to do many different things. And here you would think like, oh, okay, but it's a sacrifice because then I would lose access to the object that I really liked, like a washing machine, for example. Not necessarily. I mean, we both know how it works in Sweden. Collective washing machine is a cultural institution in Sweden. Nobody has their private washing machine. They share them. That's why Sweden has one of the lowest, you know, rate of washing machine per inhabitant. They have actually very few of them, but they're all very high quality and they're being shared for each building. So now imagine if you take France, where 96% of all households have their own washing machine, and we say, well, instead of wasting an enormous amount of time and effort and resource and energy to produce a shitload of washing machines, let's put them in common so that we can produce actually 1/4. And then we liberate some time that we can spend doing many things we would rather do than designing, manufacturing, selling, repairing washing machines. So if you apply the same logic of simplifying needs and focusing not on maximizing income, profits, or GDP, but on just optimizing needs satisfaction, on maximizing contentment, I think we will realize that the task of producing and consuming less is actually going in the direction of increasing quality of life. Why is that? Because capitalism is a system that sucks at increasing happiness. Why? Because it's not designed for that. Capitalism is a great system to accumulate capital. So if you want to just produce and consume more, having a capitalist economy is great. But the problem, and that's evident with the way GDP is calculated, is that it accumulates many different things without really differentiating the kind of things we need and the other thing that just exists because they just manage to be lucrative and make some money. So now if we take all that part of the economy that is actually today satisfying no needs, but just managing to create money actually appropriated by a few, I think we'll not only liberate a lot of time, working time and resources, but we'll also be better off.
See, to me, you make very good points. But I think many would counter what you're saying by asking you why we shouldn't expect a shrinking GDP under degrowth to also produce the negative effects that are normally associated with economic recessions. So how could we ensure that degrowth policies would actually not lead to such negative consequences like the ones we saw last in 2008 during the last big recession?
Well, by socially organizing and preparing for this, I give you an example. So some people are afraid of unemployment. And in fact, indeed, when you have episodes of recessions and depressions, well, very often you see unemployment rising. If you compare a country like Japan, Japan has been in what macroeconomists call a secular stagnation for the last 20 years. It means like no growth. But Japan has not seen an exponential rise of unemployment. There's less unemployment in Japan than there is in France. How does the Japanese do? So when there's a reduction in demand, a contraction of the economy, they reduce working time. So they share the available employment. And when demand just rises again, then they just increase working time. So now imagine we cut the French GDP in half.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Quite drastically.
Of course, that's not to be a cut in half. Generally, in certain sectors like the automobile industry, the aviation sector, advertising, financial markets, these will just... Some sectors will completely disappear. Some product will completely disappear. Some new sectors will be created. But overall, what you measure with GDP will be half of what it was yesterday. Then you still have an active population of people, and you can just adapt working time. So production and consumption is being reduced by half, which means that you will have to adapt working time and hourly labor productivity to adapt to that change. If you don't adapt and don't do anything, then you will have unemployment. But who says that, we have to let it happen? The problem with the recession is that, it's unexpected. It comes at the moment where you don't expect it. And so it's like an accident of a growth-based economy that suddenly does something bad or just find itself in the impossibility of growing. The case of degrowth is a bit different because, we've been discussing about this for the last few years. Now we have the IPCC report, tell us what to do about mitigation. So now we could say, we're going to shrink these sectors now, and we're going to reduce working hours proportionally. Then we're going to create these jobs. Then we're going to retrain these people so that they can actually move to the other jobs. What is laying behind this degrowth is a reorganization of needs satisfaction. So it's a different economic model. That's what I've developed in my PhD thesis, The Political Economy of Degrowth in 2019, explaining that actually to be able to have an economy that first cuts itself in half and then managed to prosper without further growing requires a complete rewiring of our economic system.
Towards the end, I would like to shift and talk about the political reality that we find ourselves in. Countries like Scotland, Iceland, and New Zealand have all adopted policies that emphasize metrics of well-being over metrics of growth, like the GDP. Now, rather than a full-fledged degrowth, those policies are more like soft versions of A-growth. They're more close to maybe, at least in thought, the donut economics approach. How would you assess these policy shifts? Is what these countries are doing a step in the right direction? Is it like a realistic implementation of degrowth, or is it more like greenwashing to you? What would you say? I think especially the case of New Zealand could be interesting here.
Yeah. So New Zealand, 2019, introduced the well-being budgets. So a dashboard of 65 indicators to replace GDP. I definitely think it's a step in the right direction. Actually, if you were to analyze the economic performance of New Zealand over the last decade with this dashboard of 65 indicators, I think you would realize that some form of economic growth previously measured only by GDP have been detrimental to ecological resilience and social health. So here you see the link, like by changing the indicators, we realize that some of the decisions we've been making in the past were not that wise. So that's quite an important, is changing, let's say, the brain of your economic system that tells you that, oh, now further growth is actually, making us poorer because it just degrades ecosystems, it tires people, it dissolves social relations, it just monopolizes available time. And this for very little result, most of them going into growing inequality. So that's a step in the right direction, but that's insufficient in the same way that, you know, if you're in your car driving towards a cliff and you realize that you've not been looking actually where your car were going and you were just looking at the speedometer, yeah, someone will tell you, yeah, dude, just get the dashboard and look at the direction and the speed and many different indicators. That's great. But before doing this, or at the same time, I would first say, like, brake so you don't fall off the cliff. So far, these countries, they've been changing their indicators. But I think they've not quite implemented the full implication of what this means. This actually means just, you know, shrinking the size of their economy. This means dismantling a huge part of their infrastructure, which made sense in a GDP-oriented economy, but which is now counterproductive in a well-being-oriented economy. Mm. And to do this becomes a bit more complicated, but I think this will be the next step. And we need to use the opportunity of these new indicators coming out to have this discussion. Another limit with these indicators is that they're quite nationally focused. Mm-hmm. We've been talking before about the fact that we live in a global world with limited resources. So when that study by Jason Hickel and a few other people came out at the beginning of the week showing that 74% of excess resource use at the level of the planet since the 1970s have happened in high-income countries, we realized that actually the unsustainable mode of living in rich countries is slowing down possibilities for development elsewhere. Mm. So now it's not enough, you know, just to focus on the well-being of people in New Zealand or the people in France. It's also necessary to contextualize the pursuit of well-being in these countries and historical responsibility towards colonialism and exploitation through international trade of other countries, which demand reparations, and also with the environmental implications, global environmental implications of current modes of living. So even if somehow you focus on well-being, but that level of well-being can only be sustained by monopolizing a lot of resources like metals and minerals and biomass that is then not available in the countries where you take them, well, then that is problematic because then the well-being in New Zealand and France is done at the expense of well-being somewhere else in a country where actually we would need to much more focus right now than the well-being of people in New Zealand and France. So that'll be my second limit to these indicators.
Again, on the political reality of degrowth, because I think most people would agree, or many people would agree with what you've just proposed. But if we look at the political reality in Germany, where even the Green Party advocates green growth, or in France, where the upcoming election gives no real hope of a shift away from the growth paradigm in the next 5 years. I mean, I don't know about Mélenchon's opinion on this, but he's not in the race anymore. So I feel like there's not a big chance there as well. So then imagining such a paradigm shift on a global level, even on a continental level, seems quite unlikely. Where do you get your optimism from? Or are you an optimist? What do you think of the reality of these chances?
It's depressing. Yesterday I was watching a documentary about a French food specialist who was the first candidate to run for the Green Party at the presidential election in France, so René Dumont in 1974. Mm. And that guy, who had been around more than 80 countries advising, studying, researching food production in all these countries, was just making the very same argument you find today, you know, made by degrowth scholars like Jason Hickel or Julia Steinberger or Yorgos Kallis. And so you're like, wow, that was 50 years ago. So am I going to spend my life like René Dumont, you know, to just rant against that system? And then maybe in 50 years, people will do a little anniversary like we do for the Meadows report to be like, oh, you know, they did remarkable work. We didn't care a tiny bit. But well, that was nice. They were wise. They were so. I agree with you that we need to find a different strategy, and I don't quite know where that will come from. The French presidential election was depressing. It started with very high hopes because one of the four candidates during the primary of the Green Party was Delphine Bateau, historically the first politician to defend the idea of degrowth. Not just to defend it on the side, to have degrowth as the main motto of her campaign. She was almost elected, you know, candidate for the presidential election, but lost very closely to Yannick Jadot. And then we had the election where Jean-Luc Mélenchon, representing the so-called radical left, which is becoming less and less radical in my mind, comparing the actually... nonsensicality of the world, which was defending the usual anti-capitalist line, but has been integrating a lot of the wisdoms of the Green in the last few years. So actually the ecological program of Jean-Luc Mélenchon, so radical left, was more sophisticated than the one of Yannick Jadot representing the Greens, and was integrating the kind of ideals of social ecological justice that you find in the degrowth literature, even though degrowth was not part of the political campaign, perhaps for obvious and sexy reasons. Of course, he lost in the first round of the elections, so that's out of the door. And it's very difficult to be optimist at this point. The IPCC report is perhaps a way of being optimist in the sense of, for the first time, we have a chapter on what they call demand side strategies. So sobriety, degrowth, you know, consumption-based, basically consuming less stuff. I find it surprising that somehow since the first IPCC report in the 1990, it is only now in 2022 that they decide to dedicate a full chapter to something which is quite obvious. The most renewable resource is the one you don't have to use. So, well, if you can switch to plant-based diet, ditch your car, and stop having holidays in faraway countries with a plane, then that's going to make it hell way easier to reduce emissions. Now the IPCC has just released this, and we can build on that. And I'm hoping that, you know, the IPCC is going to become this report like a bag of tea that is good, slowly diffused in society, so that everyone understands that actually, the mitigation of climate change and approaching, you know, the solutioning of ecological crisis is not just a matter of inventing new electric cars and finding minerals in space. It's first and foremost a matter of rethinking our needs, of actually stopping reflecting on our economic institutions. It's about just, you know, I like Yves-Marie Abraham, a professor in Montreal, who reduces degrowth to the slogan of producing less, sharing more, and deciding together. So I quite like this slogan. And now I hope that every time we have these overly sophisticated discussions about decoupling, we're not going to spend a decade just tweaking with the little things, and we're going to come back to this big questions of political economy. Basically, what to produce, why do we need to produce it, and how are we going to produce it?
Die Grenzen des Wachstums, planetare Belastungsräume und Kipppunkte, Green Growth, Entkopplung und Postwachstumstheorie. Um all das ging es heute. Und obwohl wir versuchen, es ganz genau zu nehmen, können wir solche komplexen Themen niemals im Rahmen einer Podcast-Folge vollkommen beleuchten. Deswegen empfehle ich allen, die mehr lernen möchten, die 2002er Neuveröffentlichung von Die Grenzen des Wachstums zu lesen. Auch nach 20 Jahren lohnt sich das vollkommen, denn das Buch ist unglaublich gut geschrieben und schafft es, wie kaum ein anderes, komplexe Themen verständlich zu erläutern. Und zum Thema Postwachstumstheorie empfiehlt Timothy Parik eine Liste von Büchern.
Well, there are a few very good books. You can find a list on my website, timothyparik.com. One of my favorite is Jason Hickel, Less is More. There is also one called Degrowth from Yorgos Kallis. And in June, there will be another one called The Future is Degrowth, which I have not yet finished it, but might be one of the best books on degrowth ever written.
Der Link zu Timothys Liste sowie zu allen anderen Quellen dieser Folge ist wie immer in den Shownotes zu finden. Danke fürs Zuhören und bis zum nächsten Mal. Ciao.